على جميع المستهلكين الحذر من المنتجات منتهية الصلاحية.
هلو هلو، اهلا بيكو في حلقة جديدة من حلقات منتهي الصلاحية، البودكاست اللي بنتكلم فيها عن الاكل مع ناس لذيذة. النهاردة معايا شيف من اعز الناس على قلبي، the mentor that guided me through this profession، وبجد من احسن الناس اللي انا بلجأ لها دايما لما بحتاج نصيحة. معانا النهاردة شيف وسام مسعود.
الكلام الكبير ده انا حاسس ان انا لازم امشي حالا.
لا ليه؟
مش عارف، لان حاسس ان انت دلوقتي هتندم، يعني ندم شديد.
لا
ان انت جبت واحد فعلا منتهي الصلاحية في البرنامج.
لا لا، على فكره هو الكونسبت بتاع البودكاست ان مفيش حاجه منتهيه الصلاحيه، مفيش حاجه اسمها انتهى الصلاحيه اصلا
خالص
خالص.
ده وزاره الصحه هيبقى يعني هيبسطوا بيه جدا.
I can guarantee you ان مفيش حاجه، it's a hoax to sell more.
اوكي شور اجريد يا تمام.
طيب let's start كده، قول لنا بقى عن نفسك اكتر. شاف وسام كده
مش عارف ببتدي منين. هو اصلا يعني انا عندي 44 سنه، ففي كتير يعني الواحد يتكلم في كتير. فببساطة شديدة أنا واحد بحب المطبخ، بحب المجال المهني بتاعت الطهي، بحب مجال المطاعم، بشتغل في مجال المطاعم. I guess رائد أعمال، an entrepreneur. Yes. Restaurant entrepreneur is the word. في مجال المطاعم. وما بحبش، عندي حساسية ضد الغباء، دي حاجة. مصطفى رفاعي يحكي لك عن الموضوع ده، بس يعني هو يقول لك لا لا، وسام بتروح منه يعني. فانا عصبي شويه، لازم تبقى عصبي.
طبعا انا اعتقد اساسا اي حد that works daily on heat and sharp objects لازم هيبقى عصبي.
Well, everything's trying to kill you. You know, everything's trying to kill you. And that's just your tools, right? Your tools and your equipment.
طيب you were a doctor صح؟
زمان. الحمد لله.
طيب when did you decide that it's time to jump from med to culinary?
I took the decision before I turned 30. I was like 29 and a half. I had been in the medical field for a few years at that point. I كنت اتخرجت واشتغلت في الابحاث ومش عارف ايه. And I hated my job. I didn't like the industry. It didn't speak to me. I didn't feel like I was a valued member of this community. And I'm using the word community very loosely. It's not a community. It's a collection of just people who all want money at the end of the day. And yeah, money is great, but like that can't be your North Star. You want to be able to create something. And even in clinical research, that wasn't immediately apparent, because you're only researching drugs that the drug companies know that they can sell. So you have some very horrible diseases that if we had applied a fraction of the research dollars applied to stuff like ibuprofen or finding an extra off-label use for paracetamol, use that for ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, it would make a huge difference in their lives. But nobody's doing that because how many patients have ALS? Right? What, a couple of 100,000 in the entire world? Halos. And mortality, they're dead within 5 years. So it's not even, you know, you don't even getting, you know, long-term benefit. Ibuprofen, عندك صداع، كل واحد عنده صداع. انت ibuprofen ده موجود جنب اللبن في البيت، يعني مفيش بيت من غير ibuprofen، مفيش بيت من غير لبن. Whereas Lou Gehrig's disease, it doesn't happen often enough. And if it does happen, it doesn't happen long enough. So it's not profitable. So I felt that was not really cool. I've always liked kitchens. I've always liked restaurants. I've always liked the creativity and thought and integrity.
When did you jump?
We said about integrity. You know, cooking and restaurants, writing about food, which is how I like to express my interest in food. I figured, you know, you can't get more honest than that in your output.
Okay.
Right? You put a plate of food in front of somebody and either like it and eat it, or don't like it and don't eat it. And so, you know, I'd been thinking about that even when I was over at, after I graduated and I was at Yale. I wanted to go to culinary school, but I was like, yeah, let me see this medicine thing. Let's see, I got a profound but let's see what happens. Yeah, and then, you know, 29, I'm turning 30, I'm about to turn 30, and I was like, yeah, I smoke 2 packs of cigarettes a day, I don't sleep, I'm not gonna live as long as I've already lived, so I might as well die happy, or die doing something that I am happy doing. So yeah, let's just jump in a kitchen and start working.
So your gift for your 30 was to be happy.
Well, first it was 6 months in the Sinai, right? Being a bum on the beach and painting houses. Which was awesome. Like, it's, yeah, it was such a great, great thing. I developed a newfound appreciation for electricity and ice. So
definitely.
Yeah. Because I was there during the summer. Smart guy going to Sinai in the summer.
You came like 4 or 5 shades darker.
4 or 5 shades darker, actually, 100%. Grew out my hair. You know, I figured, yeah, I grow out my hair before I have to, like, before it falls off, which it has, alhamdulillah. And I can't wait for the rest of it to follow because I want to shave my head. I don't want to have to deal with barbers anymore.
Well, you can shave it now. I shaved it since I was 12, 13.
The first time I shaved my head, I was maybe 9 or 10 years old because of a soccer player for my favorite soccer player for my favorite team, Gianluca Vialli, who played for Juventus in Italy.
Know nothing about football.
He was a great striker.
After the shift, there was another shift. You shifted from kitchen to corporate. Somehow.
Certainly not by my own volition.
Yeah.
One thing that I've always found very vexing and very confusing was that everybody I meet who wants to get into the restaurant industry and, you know, hired me as a consultant or whatever, always tell me, Wissam, stop being a chef, be an owner, be
the businessman.
No. Yeah. That's not why I do this. I do this because I like coming up with menus. I like coming up with different flavors and different ways of delivering those flavors to our diners. This is what I enjoy. I like that. You know, looking at an Excel sheet and coming up with a 5-year business plan is not awesome to me. I mean, I currently do that, unfortunately, but, you know.
Yeah, in the food lab.
The food lab, yes. You have any questions about the food lab?
Yes, what's the idea behind the food lab?
The food lab is... All right, I'm going to try and avoid giving a PhD thesis about the necessity or how the restaurant industry is trying to adapt with increasing real estate prices and increased labor prices. But what we're doing at the Food Lab is a direct corollary of those downward pressures, right? Okay. You have a restaurant that, you know, is open, you have to run 2 shifts, let's say, because you're open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And you have 50 seats. Breakfast, 50 people come in, lunch, 25 people come in, and dinner, maybe 25 to 30 people come in, let's just say, right? You're not at full capacity, right? Because they come in, they sit for an hour, but you're open for 16. Right? So your staff is full-time, but your customers are not. So you're paying rent, you're just blowing money away, right? Paying on rent, paying on electricity, paying on staff salaries, paying on spoilage, paying on wastage, all that good stuff. And cloud kitchens are a response to that. Ultimately, cloud kitchens want to improve, at least the way that we operate cloud kitchens. There's a number of different business models, but the way that the food lab for cloud kitchens is to improve kitchen utilization. So all of those hours of the day, we are producing, we are feeding people, paying customers. We are feeding, paying customers. And we do that through the development of creative menus, hand in hand with a very agile marketing team, very smart marketing team. And Food Lab wants to try and give profitability back to restaurants by improving the percentage labor cost, by reducing your operational waste, by reducing the opportunity costs that you're losing because you have those empty seats. But we're delivery only. We don't have any seated diners. So all of our diners happen to be sitting in dining rooms across the city.
So it's like a delivery?
It's a delivery only restaurant. Let's just make it easy. It's a delivery only collection of restaurants operating out of a single space with a single team, okay, as opposed to having 12 different teams doing 12 different menus. I got one team doing 12 different menus.
This is heavy.
It is. But that's what we've gotten really, really good at, to be honest. Yeah. Being able to train and retrain and maintain standards. It's not easy because the jobs that these guys do on the ground, it is not easy. They have to memorize 30 different types of chicken burgers, right? Because, you know, everybody has an effing chicken burger, right? So, and they do that with accuracy, and they do that with speed, and they do that with quality. And and that's down to
creates consistency.
Of course. Yeah. You know, it creates consistency until somebody says that it's not consistent. Then we see if we did something wrong.
طيب عشان احنا اتكلمنا على الريستورانتس ف how do you see the future of restaurants in Egypt? Because nowadays في ويف كده طلع جديد يا اما كله بيتجه للسمول كلاود كيتشنز اريا يا اما كله بيتجه لللكجيريوس دايننج اريا. حاسس ان في حته كده بتاعه الكاجوال دايننج از فيدنج اواي بتوين بوث اوف ذم. فالناس بقت بتتجه يا اما للساندوتشز اند برجرز اند ستاف لايك فيري close to fast food scenarios and or بقى luxurious اللي هي fork and table and very high end reservation places. حتة ال casual dining في النص بدأت تفيد بين الاتنين دول.
Who are the main customers of casual dining? Like Chili's, TGI families. Fridays, families, yeah. Right? All right. Now, families are right now, they are under a lot of pressure because of inflation.
Definitely.
So they're not dining out as often. Mm. They're still delivering. Mm. Like they're eating my food, right? Yeah. They're eating Food Lab's food. But The people who are still going out, you know, on a semi-regular basis, these are your Gen Z, I think, is the right now that's the current generation. Like, not even millennials at this point. Millennials are getting married and having kids.
I'm not.
Well, you're at the tail end. Well, you're a unique gem. But the Gen Z and Gen Alpha and whatever, the subsequent generations, these are guys who are eating out. They want an experience. So they want the Smashburger experience. They want the Nashville Hot Chicken experience. They want the melted cheese on an ice cream cone experience,
yeah.
Right? The Instagram virality, because all those people are on Instagram or TikTok.
Pleasing food.
Well, that's doing a lot of heavy lifting. It has aesthetics.
Right? It's not pleasing.
I mean, yeah, right. I guess at this point. So those are the people who are driving the demand. And you have new restaurant owners trying to come in and trying to fulfill that demand. Some people are trying to fulfill it by copy-paste. Mm. So that's the trend, quote unquote. And they just copy what somebody else does. So Smashburgers, everybody's doing a Smashburger. But if you go back, everybody was doing a burger concept. Yeah. Right. I remember in Cairo, the three burger concepts that had started pretty much within 12 months of each other were Burger Joint in Zamalek, which I think had a maximum of two branches and then just kept to one branch. Very good burger at the time. So you had Burger Joint, you had Gourmet Burger. I think it was called the Gourmet Burger Company, owned by the same people of Pizza Mia, who then had Gelato Mio, and then they exited and they sold it to somebody else. And then you had Mince. Elo can fatah aslan fi makan kan kwafir. They had this really cool
story.
All in Zamalek, yes. Once again, right?
Because the customer was in Zamalek.
Because the customer was at Zamalek. These are the taste makers, right? These are the people who talk about it. And there's no social media, so you really had to push on word of mouth. But it was burgers, right? And then you go to Bursaid and people are doing burgers. عايزين نفتح محل برجر عايزين نفتح محل. طب الخلطه البرجر ايه لا هو ما فيش خلطه للبرجر حضرتك هو ملح وفلفل ده لو انت حطيت فلفل كمان يعني لحمه حلوه جميل and then you know you start say, buying more Angus beef or Australian beef and then
that's quality getting, it's a quality
then it becomes a quality thing and you start oh okay let's do use a brioche bun. Oh, wow, rocket science, amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, but these are all trends and people copy-pasting. All these restaurants are just following a trend and they don't know why. The smart people are trying to create new experiences. Okay. There's a place that opened up very recently and they're creating an experience, an alternative experience to going out to the, you know, and we're using this term very loosely, the quote-unquote fine dining restaurants, right? Or the restaurants that have a higher level quality of cooking and food and ingredients and doorbells, but they're creating an experience. For those 20 guys, instead of going out to have fun at Bui or Kiki's or Sachi or wherever, so it's a very cool concept. It's an arcade, and the concept has existed outside of Egypt for a number of years, and I've tried to get a lot of investors into it, like 5-6 years ago. And everybody's like, "La, مش هشتغل في مصر."
Is that Breast Monkey?
That's Breast Monkey.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember the name.
Yeah.
But the food is nice. It is exactly what you're describing. It is that casual, fast casual dining food. Your artichoke dip, your battered coconut shrimp, you have a burger, you have your appetizer. There's a buffalo chicken burger. I don't know what is on the menu, but I'm telling you, like, I'm probably going to get five items right. You know, they definitely do not have a club sandwich, which I think is a crime. Everybody needs to have a club sandwich. Yeah. Call it spinoff.
Yeah.
Tahrif.
Yeah.
Right. So I think the old definition of casual dining is changing. But like I said earlier, right, who are the main customers? They're families. Families are not going out. It is interesting, though, because I was listening to another a business podcast. I'm not a businessman, but I was listening to a business podcast talking about Chili's. And Chili's in the United States has been going through a bit of an upturn recently. And the reason why is because they realized their menu was too big. They also realized that they had too many seats that were empty for longer periods throughout the day. And they also realized, and the third thing is that they didn't have a customer experience, even though that's how Chili's got to be Chili's.
Yeah.
Because they afforded a customer experience to the Gen Xers that baby boomers didn't have in the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, you would go to a very sort of stale place, and now you're going to this place with flair and music and knickknacks and,
They reshaped the American diner concept.
Of course. The American dining scene has been heavily influenced by Brinder. The guy's name is Brinder, the guy who started Chili's. Brinder, I think was his name. Chili's is on its way back is because they've understood, okay, we got to go back to experience. Restaurant owners don't, new ones, they think everybody, you make huge profit margins on food. You do not make huge profit margins on food. You just don't, okay? It is a very tough job. And if you don't provide hospitality to your customers, and more, and as importantly, do not provide a customer experience, hospitality is part of that experience. You want to be welcoming. You want to make sure he's got a nice place to sit. All that's part of hospitality. But at the same time, you want him to be engaged, because the current generation, the coming up, upcoming generations, they're way more stimulated than I was when I was growing up. What would I do on a lazy Friday afternoon after coming back from the mosque in Saudi Arabia? I'm going to read the newspaper. You know, that's a great time. The only stimulation I had was the sound of the crinkling paper. That was it. Like the physical auditory stimulation. But now you have music on demand. You know, nobody's recording tapes anymore and waiting for their favorite song to come on the radio. Yes. You know, everything is on demand. Food is on demand. Yes. So it's
the fast pace of life.
Well, I mean, it's because everything is more available. Everything is more available because we want it to be more available. Nobody has patience anymore for people who honk their horns in the street.
Definitely.
You know, nobody has patience anymore to wait for their friend to come back from a trip to wherever to tell them all about food and then write with a pen and paper. Nobody writes with a pen and paper anymore.
Yeah, you have a story now.
Yeah.
Have a story to
you got to have a story and pictures that are immediately that I've seen. Like I watched you while you were in your trip as you were eating it, and I watched you stuff this cheese filled thing into your fat face. Like
enjoy the moment.
Yeah, I don't want to get into the whole, like, because now we have this whole the trend of videos. I'm about to rant right now. I'm an old man. I'm allowed to rant. This whole trend of videos, people,
this is
like
a free speech podcast.
It's disgusting.
Definitely.
Qasam billah, it's disgusting. Yeah, okay, great. Talk about food, please. And I love all of them. You know, I know a lot of them personally, but like, please do not eat in front of the camera. I don't want to see your teeth. I don't want to see your tongue, right? And if you're eating a messy burger, you're going to be messy. And I don't want to see a messy person eating.
Yes.
Because if you're sitting at a dinner table with your family and somebody who's eating like that, would that be good manners or bad manners?
Bad manners.
Basically. Then why are you putting that shit on the internet?
Because it's viral. It gives them money.
You know what else is viral? Money, yeah. You know what else is viral? COVID-19.
Yeah, okay? Definitely.
We don't want COVID-19, right? AIDS is viral.
Yeah, wow.
So, okay. Yeah, I mean, I know I'm going off on a tangent, but
هي فعلا the concept of food blogging is different. لأن كلمة
blog,
ما دي حاجة برضو.
They're not food bloggers. No, I'm sorry. They're not food bloggers.
محتاجة تعريف برضو.
No, there's
blogging
not food bloggers.
That means that you should have a website, it's called a blog, that you write an article on describing what experience you had. A video is not a blogging, it's vlogging. It's different.
Sure. I'll tell you, food blogging started in Egypt before 2011.
Yeah.
Okay. There were three people writing about food in Egypt at the time. There was Sara Khanna, Buttered Up Blog. I think she still has the name Buttered Up Blog for all her social media. You had David Blanks, who used to write for the Daily News Egypt when that was an actual physical newspaper. And then you had somebody else called Not Hungry Because I Ate. Now, I remember I got into blogging because I read an article in Time Magazine saying that the best burger in the world was at Lucille's in Maidi. It's like, okay, you know, this is 2009, Stephen something, I don't remember his name. So I went and it was super crowded because Lucille's is a good restaurant. Like it was a very, very popular restaurant. It still is to this day.
Yeah.
So I went to Lucille's, me and my brother, and we're like, it's a nice burger. It's not the best burger in the world. I think the guy was just homesick. He was in Cairo. He wanted a burger and they made a semi-decent burger. Right. Now, the problem is he also wrote in that burger that they put fish sauce on the burger as it goes onto the griddle. And apparently it's a thing for people to put fish sauce in their beef mince. And I hate it.
Okay.
I don't think it adds a desired flavor. You're just hiding the quality of the meat. But anyways, so blogging was an outlet for us to write about what we are genuinely interested in. And you're not just writing about like you're not making listicles, right? You're not BuzzFeed. Right.
Yeah.
This is before BuzzFeed. So you're not just making listicles, right? Which is a list of, you know, top five French fries in Egypt. Right. You're writing generally about your experiences with food. And you have to have, you know, to be a good blogger is not easy because you have to have consistency in your output. You have to engage your readers. It's like you're a writer. You're a writer, but you're just talking about the subject matter you're talking about is food.
Food.
Right. And, you know, how many people are really interested in reading long form articles about the nuances between, you know, a risotto and labba or, you know, milk-based risotto.
Okay.
So what's happening now, these are not bloggers, right? The term blogging, I mean, we don't physically surf the internet, right?
Yeah.
right? It used to be back in my day when the internet started coming out, we used to call the information superhighway. But you don't surf the internet physically, right? So blogging, I think, just became a verb. You know, I'm less offended by, you know, using, oh, I'm a food blogger. Fine, okay. Convey some knowledge. Don't write a restaurant review because that's not blogging about food. Yeah. That's telling me what you're eating. And if you're not interesting, then I'm not interested in what you eat. Because Briat Savarin, who was the first food blogger, really, in my opinion, or among the first, he was a lawyer and he was also a gastronome. And he used to like writing about food and the culture of food. And he had a few recipes, but he said, show me what you eat and I'll show you what you are. If you're stuffing cheese-filled bourrèche into your face, does that mean you're full of fat? If you eat in a disgusting way, are you a disgusting person, right? You're not conveying knowledge. And this is my problem. And it's not just me. This is a global thing, right? You know, and then they start holding brands hostage. I have horror stories from friends of mine who operate very successful, very well-regarded industry, regards them very well, and customers, alhamdulillah, in Dubai. And they're like, food bloggers, they can shut you down if you're not careful. And there are a few that found a different way of fighting back against them. It's like, listen, you know, you want to blog, you want to write about my food. You're a paying customer. So I'm going to give you my experience. I'm not going to give you anything extra that somebody else doesn't get and they pay and you don't, right? Yeah. Why should you be treated any differently? Right. The only people who eat for free at those restaurants tend to be other industry personnel who are also, you know, feeling the pain. So they're like, yeah, dude, give him a free meal. He's a chef, you know, just, you know, have a heart. So, yeah, the food, I don't know how we got to food bloggers, but there are very few of them who know what they're talking about and have content that is actually worth digesting.
نرجع بقى تاني لحتة الكلاود كيتشن لأن this is an important part. Do you believe that cloud kitchens will take over the casual fast service dining?
Hell no. No way.
Okay.
Because it's not a substitute.
Okay.
It's not a substitute. It's the amount of people who are opening cloud kitchens these days is crazy. And I can't help but laugh every time somebody's like, I want to open up a cloud kitchen. I'm like, why? Like, what about cloud kitchens do you think is attractive for you as a business owner? Because opening cloud kitchen, it's not easy, right? It is not easy. And you have to solve for a lot of problems. And your customer is not within arm's reach. So you can't handle him easily if he has a complaint. Handling a complaint for any one of our tens of thousands of customers that we serve on a monthly basis is possibly one of the more critical tasks that we do. And we're very focused on it, you know? And it's not because I'm worried that somebody is going to bad word of mouth or anything. Like, no, because we genuinely want people to enjoy what we're offering. And that's in our company DNA. So if you want to open up a cloud kitchen, go for it, man. There's 5 different business models. Good luck. Because a cloud kitchen, depending on the business model, a cloud kitchen relies on other restaurant owners to use your service. And those guys don't know what they're doing. And if they don't know what they're doing and you don't know what you're doing, then it's a matter of the blind leading the blonde. Everybody's dancing in the dark.
Unfortunately, but I think that the cloud kitchens will not take over the casual dining, but it might take over the fast service.
No, it won't. It won't either. I'll tell you why. Because the data is showing that, cloud kitchens really saw their peak during COVID, right? After COVID, there was a bit of a lag while everybody opened up and sort of understood that COVID is the new normal, right? You're going to get COVID. It's going to happen, right? I think 4 people in my office had COVID last week. It's fine. Yeah. Right? Bala social distancing, bala bta. Well, I didn't even wear a damn mask. But now they're like, I don't want to sit at home and eat. Let's go out, you know, let's go out and have stuff. So more people, the data is showing globally, more people are going back to restaurants, right? Mm-hmm. And now they're going back to restaurants with a different set of expectations, not just quality of food or imaginativeness or any of that stuff. They want an experience. I don't want to open up a menu and then you fill up my water and tell me still or sparkling and then, you know, head out to some cave and bring me some food, you know, some freshly slaughtered animal that's been put on a grill. Like, they want something. You have to engage them.
Yeah.
They're craving not attention, but they're craving engagement.
Yes.
So, and a delivery only concept or a virtual concept, right? A concept that lives really on the cloud. That's how you're engaging with them. You're engaging with them electronically or through a phone call. You don't have a face-to-face conversation with these people. Creating that engagement is very difficult. It is very difficult for virtual brands. We have 7 brands. We didn't get it right on every single brand, but we're getting better at it because we've made enough mistakes, right? So we've learned from our mistakes, you know? So the next brand is always better than the first one we were able to forecast better and so on and so forth. Our first brand, I thought it was a great offering. I still feel kind of bad that it didn't really succeed, but I know why it didn't succeed. But our last brand, day one, knocked it out of the park because we developed it to be engaging. We thought about how the people are going to engage with it in colors, how the people are going to engage with it sensorially, right? Organoleptically, layers of texture, there's layers of flavor. You know, you have to think about these things. You have to sort of turn up the saturation to 11, right? When you're delivering food at home, because you can't rely on the music that you're playing. You can't rely on a good looking waiter or waitress. You can't rely on this wonderful interior design made by any of the geniuses that we have working in Egypt. You're really relying on
the food.
That's what you're relying on.
Type. Since you were talking about that people are seeking an experience, as a chef and as a business owner now, as an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. what's your take on pop-up dinners? Because I have an idea.
Okay.
I think pop-up dinners are like the, you know, the Wikipedia page for how to start a fine dining place. I think it's like elevating the people mindset into getting into the course menu.
I remember the first chef's table or pop-up table, pop-up dinner that I did. It was me, Mustafa Rafai, and Ayman Samir. And we did it at the Cellar Door Bistro. We wanted it as an outlet. And there were actually David Blanks and Sarah Hanna and other people at Ahram English had written articles about it. And, you know, it was an outlet for us to do something that we don't do in our daily work. I'm trying to remember where I was working at the time. But there are some things I just couldn't put on the menu. Like, I can't put beef tongue on the menu, you know, because it's just not going to sell. So I think it depends on who's organizing the table, right? Who's organizing the pop-up dinner. Everybody that I know who's doing pop-up dinners, right? Which is, you know, multi-course menus. This is their creative expression. It's like it's a limited time only gallery, right? Limited time painting exhibition at, you know, Townhouse Gallery or Tam Gallery or any one of those galleries. So it's good that more and more people are doing it and more people are, I think, you know, if 100 people are doing it, I think maybe, 50 people are actually doing it the second time. And of the people who do it the second time, maybe 10 or 15 actually improve it for the third time. They continually think about it and improve the customer experience, right? But I'm glad it's happening, you know, and I'm glad that the appetite is there because I think the appetite has always been there because it is a unique experience. It is very, you know, about my obsession with Japan, right? So one of the things in Japan is cherish every single moment because the moment will not come again. You and I are sitting across the table. We've had countless conversations. We will continue to have countless conversations, but we will never have a conversation exactly like this. It is every conversation is a fingerprint. They're similar, but they're not the same. So I think that, and in that sense, with the predominant target set of the, you know, Gen Z, it is impermanent. It is temporary, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, catch it, experience it now, yes. And then put it on TikTok, right? Fine, that's great. But you know, you can say I was there, right? And I went through that experience. And whether you enjoyed it or not, you know, hopefully, I know every single chef, every single person who's done a pop-up dinner wants people to really, really enjoy it because they're putting themselves out there. They're being as honest to themselves as they possibly can. And economic considerations prevent them from doing that at their own restaurants, right? But they still have this itch that they need to scratch. So yeah, let me do a pop-up dinner. Yeah, it's a little bit more expensive than eating at my restaurant, but you're gonna get a more personalized chef experience. So I think it's great that it's happening. The appetite has always been there. We were always booked. We did, I think, 3 collaborative dinners. There were 6 hands. Well, back then, nobody used the word term 6 hands. We called it Chef's Table Cairo, but we did 3 6 hands dinners, me, Mustafa, and Ayman, and we were always booked, and 60 seats, 30, you know, we did two showings. What I'd like to see different is, so these are pop-up dinners, right? And linguistically, that's a very accurate description,
yeah.
Right? We don't have any pop-up restaurants yet.
Yeah.
Yet. But I don't want to talk anymore about this because I have a spoiler alert.
Okay. Spoiler alert. Nothing. Yeah. Interesting. Do you think that pop-up dinners is the introduction, how it's introducing the tasting menus in restaurants, like high-end restaurants starting to think about putting a tasting menu of 12 courses per month, مثلاً, based on the demand of how people are attending pop-up dinners?
That's an interesting question. I'm a bit skeptical. Because the decision on what goes on a menu and what doesn't is very rarely the chef's decision in the restaurant, right? How many restaurants do you know where you are confident that it is the chef who's making a decision on what's on the menu and what's not?
Not much. Here in Egypt. In Egypt, yeah. I don't think much.
You can count them on one hand.
3, 4?
Yeah, barely.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're not making decisions and you want to do a multi, you know, you want to do a tasting menu, a degustación, and the restaurant owner is like, no, dude, because is it going to free me up? I mean, it's going to occupy a table for 3-4 hours. And I don't think I can sell our table. I don't think I can sell the seat for that much. فلا دخل بني آدم. Oh, يعني if you're going to do a tasting menu for 3,500, 4,000, 6,000 Egyptian pounds, but you're sitting there for 3 hours, you know, so that's what, 2,000 pounds an hour. لا باشا هات واحد يطلب فيلي أسترالي على a couple of whatever مش عارف ايه اخذ منه 2,200 بس تمام, we'll turn over that table 3 times. So the restaurant ownership needs to change. You're right. So restaurant owners, the way that they run restaurants as investments. They run restaurants as, they don't invest on their restaurant. Even they choose their words subconsciously. أنا صرفت على المطعم, مش أنا استثمرت في المطعم. And there's literally 2 people I know who are in the restaurant industry, maybe 3, who have the more celebrated restaurants in the country. And I'm talking sit down, fork and knife, like proper like restaurants who invest. بيستثمروا. Everybody else spends money on their restaurant. So you get what you give. You're not going to have a restaurant that has that has a kitchen team that you've nurtured and celebrated. That's, let's say you have to celebrate your kitchen team and then ask them to put a tasting menu on there and then back them up, right? Think about it, the split of tips between the front of house and back of house. Who do you think gets paid more, the waiters or as a share of the tips? Who do you think gets paid more, the kitchen or the staff or the front of house?
Front of house.
Yeah, why? Do they sell hospitality?
Somehow, yes.
You shouldn't be selling hospitality. You give hospitality, but you sell food. We don't give the food, right? You order on a menu. You don't say, I'd like a plate of good manners and no body odor, please, from my waiter. You don't order that, right? That's a given. That should be given to you. But, you know, I want my fried calamari. It's got to be hot. It's got to be crispy. It's got to have the right sauce with it. And yalla bean, and it's got to come quick. So there's like literally 2 guys in the airplane above us. You're paying for the food that you have at the restaurant. You're not paying for the hospitality because you're supposed to, that's what you're right as a customer. Now, the split is, you know, you would think it should, الواجب should be مثلا ايه 50-50. الواجب يعني ما هو ده بيعمل شغل والتاني برضو بيتعب صراحة. No, it's usually 70-30, 80-20. 20% for the kitchen, 30% for the kitchen tops. The rebuttal to that is usually, oh no, but chefs get paid more than waiters. And I'm usually like, yeah, no, they don't. They absolutely do not.
Yeah.
Right. So let's not just have that conversation. If everybody thinks that's if they are in the restaurant industry and they pay their chefs more than their waiters, please keep on doing what you're doing, right? And start celebrating, keep on, you know, celebrating. But if you pay your waiters more than your chefs, I know why you do it, right? But you should try paying your chefs a little bit better. Yeah. Maybe they'll stick around for a little longer and maybe they'll actually be more mindful of their job function.
طيب, برضو you were on Cairo Food Week. Do you think Cairo Food Week will pave the way for fine dining places to open in Egypt? Because I think it has drawn attention that people have good culinary mindsets. We have good chefs. We have good quality of creativity somehow. And they've collaborated with international chefs and created amazing menus. So do you think the investment of a fine dining place, a real fine dining place, because people here in Egypt mix between luxury dining and fine dining.
What do you think is the difference?
I think the difference is in fine dining, you give more creative freedom to the chef to create his own food because it's based around the chef.
Okay.
Luxury dining is like an elevated experience where while I am not gonna get the normal cotton whatever, I will get the high-end cotton napkins next to me, the high-end
I'm gonna have to disagree with you. I think they misinterpret what you need to do to have a fine dining restaurant.
Yeah.
Right? Now, a fine dining restaurant is about quality. It is of fine quality. Right now, luxury says, listen, I'm giving you quality because I'm putting alba truffles on your risotto. I am whitewashing over any I'm promising to give you the best in the world, the most expensive, right? Not the most well created. At the end of the day, there's technique, right? So if you do you know, Wagyu filet with black truffle sauce, technically it's not hard to do. Like, you don't need a lot of technique to do it. You don't need a lot of technique to plate it up, because you're just going to throw that thing in the center of the plate, pour the sauce on top, and throw some microgreens from Abdurrahman Nassif over at NatureWorks, and Moda, pretty much done. But that's luxurious. That is luxurious. But if you go to, and I, putting gold on food is not luxurious. That's just safah and tabdir and yes. Like everything wrong with the world. Like, it's like having a gold toilet seat. Why? You don't need a gold toilet seat. Nobody needs that, right? You just don't need it. I need a well-cooked plate of food, you know.
Yeah, you don't need a gold leaf on your steak.
You don't need gold leaf on the steak. And yeah, I need it on my ceiling. Yeah. Yes, because that is aesthetically pleasing. I don't need it on my food, and I don't need it on my...
So I think... that's why I say in fine dining... that fihna mushkila.
We don't have fine dining in Egypt. And we will not have fine dining in Egypt. There were a number of attempts to do fine dining in Egypt, and the clientele, it's not part of our culture. It's not the way that we have a conversation with food.
Okay.
Right? We don't interact with food in that way. Fine dining, even globally, is, you know, that old, when you say fine dining, close your eyes, you're thinking of, you know, Louis XVI in Monaco, right? Where you have the gold plated or gold, you know, silver sterling forks, and you have 15 forks on the left and the right, and that comes with etiquette, and you need to, the waiters with the gloves and the thing, and monsieur, would you like some profiterole with your chanterelle, or whatever the hell they say, right? Yeah, nobody wants that anymore.
Okay.
It's too rigid, right? But you have concepts like Orfali Bros Bistro in Dubai, right? Yeah. Best restaurant in the Middle East, 3 years running. The food there is superlative. The food there is creative. The food there is error-free, as it should be, right? But also, it's very personal. If you don't like a plate of food at Orfali Bros Bistro, it's not because it was badly made or anything. It's because you don't see eye to eye with what he thinks food should taste like. And I would say, if you don't see eye to eye with Mohammed Orfali and how food should taste like, you need to get your eyes checked, right?
Eyes and
yeah.
soul.
Yeah, because, you know, the food there is bananas. It's very enjoyable. It's fun to eat as well. There is engagement, right? So... yeah, I mean, would you call it a fine dining restaurant?
I don't know.
No, it's not a fine dining restaurant. Okay. It doesn't... there are certain criteria that a fine dining restaurant needs to fulfill. Like, it actually has a loose set of rules, right? You walk into Orfeli's Bistro, there's no dress code, so you're not fine dining. Done. Huh. Finished.
Okay, yeah.
Right? Nobody wants fine dining anymore. Like, nobody wants it.
It's a bit restrictive.
The chef doesn't want it. The restaurant owner doesn't want it because he's got to buy the 600 thread count Egyptian cotton linens and put that on the table, and he's got to iron that stuff. And like, it's a whole, and you have to spend money on staff training. Like, it's very expensive yeah. to run a fine dining restaurant, right? And even the Michelin guide is beginning to understand, like, you know, because... three Michelin-starred restaurants, by and large, are all fine dining restaurants.
Yeah.
Right? There's a reason why Noma never got three stars, because it was more casual, right? It had that same sort of conversational experience that you find at Orfeli Bros, or that you find at, what's the place that's number one last year?
Central?
No. The year after. This this last year, the place in Spain. The guys who were at El Bui. You know, or you know, restaurants like White Rabbit or with Alex Atala or any one of the, or June's or any one of those places, right? Yeah, but how many people are excited going to the French Laundry outside of people who actually really understand who Thomas Keller is and what, and have their books and yeah. I have the French, I have a cookbook, to one of Thomas Keller's books called Under Pressure, and I got a friend of mine got it for me autographed. It's one of my...
wow.
Like, yeah.
This is a treasure.
And Tom, so I actually have had a one-sided conversation with Chef Thomas Keller, and he's like, it's all about time and temperature. That's what cooking is. And that, you know, we were talking about this guy earlier, right? And that's like the Zen. Yes. He's the Zen master.
Yes.
Right? Go to David Chang's restaurants. David Chang had a couple of two Michelin-starred restaurants. Love David Chang. Like, my favorite, right? Mm. The guy's rock and roll. He is rock and roll. He's not doing fine dining. Two Michelin starred. I think he had one. I know he had a couple of one Michelin star. I had food over there at Mapesh in New York. Just bananas. So good. Even the food I didn't like, I liked. But it was very casual. I was sitting at the bar. I was wearing shorts. Walked in. Didn't have a reservation. It was awesome. Right? People are having fun. A restaurant where people are having fun is not one where the waiter is wearing gloves.
Yeah.
right? So do we need fine dining in Egypt? No. Do we need luxurious dining in Egypt? What's the exchange rate of the USD to Egyptian pound? Yeah, I think that answers the question.
Yeah. Okay. I will ask you the last question.
I talk too much. Yeah, no, I get it. Sure. Awesome.
This is nice. This is a nice question. Mm-hmm. For the people who I call them the shapeshifters. Okay. I'm a shapeshifter. Sure. You're a shapeshifter. Anyone who shifted their careers is a shapeshifter.
Okay.
So for the shapeshifters, give us 5 advices to people who want to shift to culinary arts.
Oh, yeah. I get asked that question a lot. Usually it's the same answer. Don't.
Wow. That's the number one advice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other 4.
My first advice would be don't do it. Second advice, please don't do it. Third advice, you better not do it. Now, if after those 3 things you've been warned, the next thing is don't complain. Don't complain. Don't complain that you're working longer hours for less pay. Don't complain. You did this to yourself.
Yeah.
Right? And the last piece of advice is enjoy everything. Enjoy when you're slammed in the kitchen and you can't fulfill orders. That is enjoyment because that is a learning moment. Enjoy when your customers are happy. Enjoy the customer who takes time to eloquently articulate what they didn't like about the food. Because those customers, sadly, are few and far between. The people who can actually tell you what was to give you constructive feedback. I've gotten feedback on mishfahmu. And I have an internal dialogue. When I walked in this morning, you heard, you listened to the song I was listening to. Yeah. That's the song, right? It's a song by a band called Silverchair. And the first line is, I hate you and your apathy, right? That is what's playing in my head. So, you know, those customers who give you constructive criticism are very valuable. They're very valuable because they will tell you how you can improve, not what you did wrong. And those are 2 very different things. And it's really hard to tell a chef to be able to absorb that kind of criticism in a positive way because there's ego. And where does that ego come from? Well, I spent 16 hours making this plate of food for you. And now you're telling me my food isn't good enough? Put that off to the side, right? You want to, if this customer takes the time in a smiling way and is trying to give you knowledge about how you can possibly think in a different way, appreciate that. The customers who come and say, مش حاسس بالطبق, يعني, there's death metal in my head playing at that rage, just rage internally. And the first 3 responses out of my mouth are usually very abrasive and very hurtful.
Okay.
Like, that's number 1. All right. Second thing is, أنا مش فاهمه. إيه اللي تفهم؟ It's food. إحنا أنت مش عند في مدرسة, right?
Tasted, boy.
Yeah. Just, did you enjoy it? And that's why when you touch tables, you ask, did you enjoy your dinner with us? The phrasing of that sentence is very important. Did you enjoy? I want you to enjoy. أنت شبعت؟ لا. أنا مش مامتك عشان أقول لك أنت شبعت ولا لا. Honestly, أنا مش مامتك. Right? Because I've asked that, الأكل كان حلو قوي بس because their stomach is rumbling like the motorcycle. Yeah. Then you know you have a portion size problem. I've gotten comment, الأكل لا لا تسلم إيدك وبتاع وجميل وعجبني الطعم ومش عارف إيه وكل الكلام ده بس أنا مش بعتش. And my response is like, هو الأكل الحلو ما بيشبعش. الأكل الحلو ما بيشبعش. Because you always want more. Because you're not eating for a physical need anymore. You're eating for an emotional need.
For enjoyment.
Well, emotional. It's called emotional hunger.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, order another one, man. I got bills to pay. So yeah, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. If you do it, don't complain. And the last thing, honestly, enjoy every single minute because if you do find those little wins, they add up, and it is the best job in the world. Then hopefully you can reach that Zen master status of Thomas Keller.
The Thomas Keller state of mind.
Yeah. Thomas Keller state of mind.
I have a last advice that I will say, mm-hmm. that learn and get any information from the young, from the old, from anyone who got an information, just use it. It's an information after all. Use it to your benefit. Try it, learn, practice, and kill it. Thank you so much, it was a very, very lovely conversation.
Habibi.
I enjoyed it to the max. أكيد you will be with us again. I'm gonna wait for this.
I will try not to listen to rage music at 9 o'clock in the morning. Because I felt the whole time I was actually like very, very certain. I had this dour attitude and very, you know, and yeah. And
yeah, I'm going to send you a good playlist. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Thank you again for being with us today. And thank you all. وشكرا لكم ان انتم سمعتوا الحلقة دي. واستنوني في حلقة جديدة من منتهي الصلاحية. Bye.